Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. For the past 40 years, Section 8 of the Federal Housing Act has been helping low-income residents make their monthly rent while retaining the right to choose, to some degree anyway, where they live through a Housing Choice Voucher Program. Here in New York, where nearly 300,000 residents rely on these vouchers to make rent, the program has long been upheld as one of the most effective and successful low-income housing programs available, partly because it strives to create economically diverse neighborhoods around the city, while also reducing the number of public sector housing projects that need to be built. But a new series of reporting and data analyses by WNYC in conjunction with the Daily News shows that this program is no longer working as well as it was intended to in this way. So here to talk about their new investigation into Section 8 housing are WNYC Urban Affairs reporter Cindy Rodriguez, producer on WNYC's Data News team, Jenny Yee, and freelance investigative reporter Lisa Reardon-Seville, author of the version of the series published in the Daily News. Thanks for coming on the show, everybody. Hi.
Hi, Brian.
Good morning.
One of the most important aims of Section 8 has always been to disperse poverty in the city, meaning that instead of clustering low-income residents in the same neighborhoods, isolated from the rest of society and where they live, housing vouchers give them more choice and produce more integration. Cindy, after analyzing the numbers, you're finding that this is no longer as true. So crunch away. What's changing?
Well, Brian, I think what we found was that, as you were saying, you know, Section 8 was supposed to be sort of an alternative to public housing because public housing was seen as a place where poverty was concentrated, and it was seen as Section 8 was seen as a better alternative. So what we found was that, you know, 78% of people with a Section 8 voucher are living in areas where there's at least 20% of the population is living in poverty. So that means for a family of three, surviving on $21,000 or less. So these are neighborhoods that are concentrated with poverty. We saw trends where, for instance, in Bedford-Stuyvesant, this is a neighborhood that has become more affluent, and you can see how the vouchers have disappeared from that area. You can also see in the Grand Concourse, that is an area where vouchers are concentrated, where it's a reliable spot where people could find Section 8 housing. And there is still plenty of Section 8 housing there, but you can see also a large number have sort of gone away from the Grand Concourse, too. And that is partly because of gentrification, but it's also partly because of this issue where the city is, where you have these Section 8 tenants competing with the city because the city is renting apartments from landlords to house the homeless.
Jenny, do you want to add any data to that description by Cindy?
Sure. We looked at the data we looked at goes back to 2000, and it's federal data. And we have a map online that where you can see just where the Section 8 households have been able to live over the last 15 years. In 2000, about 75% of all Section 8 households lived in the Bronx or Brooklyn. That is still the case today. There are neighborhoods like East Tremont in the Bronx or the Hasidic part of Williamsburg where one in five households are Section 8 households. And then there are neighborhoods on the other end, like the Upper East Side, the West Village, Douglaston and Queens, where less than 0.5% of the households are Section 8 households.
And Lisa, in part one of your print version in the Daily News, you tell us in 2009, voucher tenants were doing better than in 2000, but in the last 7 years, as the city has boomed, those gains have been obliterated. By what measures?
So we saw about a 10% shift from 2000 to 2009. I believe it was down to about 74%, and that was at a peak, so there were more vouchers than 74% of people living in impoverished neighborhoods. And since then, we've seen an increase back to almost, 82% of people living in impoverished neighborhoods. So, you know, that tracks with the recession. We can't say that's one for one, but what appears to be happening is there was, a trend where people were able to live in what are called higher opportunity areas, and that seems to have sort of backslid in the last 6 years or so.
One of the more unsettling points that you all bring up is, as you wrote it in your daily news piece, failing inspections has been a way that some landlords have pushed tenants out. Cindy, one of the tenants you spoke to has experienced this and describes it in this clip from your series.
Landlord failed the inspection, and if the repairs are not done, then I must move out the apartment because it's under unsafe conditions.
So, am I getting this right, Cindy? A landlord refuses to fix a problem, and when housing inspectors come around, who are supposed to be there to protect the low-income tenants in the first place, they deem the building unsafe, and that forces the tenants to leave?
Right. Well, you know, Section 8, if you're a Section 8 landlord, you have to agree to have your apartment inspected every year. And if your apartment does not pass inspection, then they want the tenant to move because the thought is this is supposed to protect tenants from living in poor conditions. And to some degree it does, but it also allows sort of an easy out for a landlord who is trying to push out a tenant, or a roundabout way of pushing out a tenant, I guess. So these ladies in Ridgewood, Queens, have been tenants for a very long time. They lived in Ridgewood when they say their building was crime-ridden. Ridgewood is vastly changing right now and gentrifying. They want to stay. Something that we found in our reporting was that the best way for a Section 8 tenant to really live in what's considered sort of this higher opportunity area is to withstand the forces of gentrification and stay where they're at. So that's what these ladies are trying to do. Their apartments, though, kept failing inspections. One of them, the young woman that you just heard, got a letter saying that she was going to have to move in June if the landlord had not finished fixing her apartment. So, but these ladies had an attorney. They were well organized. They got HPD to come in and inspect their apartments. They took the landlord to court and really forced the landlord to make some changes. And this landlord has agreed to make those changes so that these tenants can stay in their apartments.
But Lisa, that sounds like a case-by-case basis, and it's every tenant having to try to find a lawyer and fight it for themselves. Otherwise, the landlord can renovate the building after they on purpose fail a building inspection and rent the empty units at market rates, which seems like an incredible loophole and so unjust, using policy designed to protect tenants to actually evict them. Does the city not get the scam?
I think the city is in a bind. On the one hand, someone in the course of this reporting mentioned to me, you know, a lot of poor tenants trade a perfect apartment for an apartment they can afford. And that is a sort of trade-off that you can make as a, well, as any New York renter, mm-hmm. I think, but particularly as a poor renter with limited options. Section 8 doesn't really offer you that option. And I think the city is in a bind because on the one hand, they don't want to lower the standards of the apartment. And on the other hand, they don't want people to be displaced because the city and NYCHA, which administers a lot of vouchers, will say, you know, they know how hard it is to find an apartment and it's taking people a long time, and about a third of the people who went looking for an apartment after they had to transfer because their house failed an inspection didn't find one and they lost their voucher probably permanently.
Cindy, same question. Does the city not get the scam?
Yeah, I just wanted to say also that, you know, to be fair to landlords, these inspections are often criticized for being very inconsistent. And so, you know, what one inspector wants, another inspector doesn't. And so I think to some degree, landlords complain that these inspections are not really fair and they need to be done in a more consistent way. But I think Lisa is right. I think people make trade-offs, and I think that the city is, you know, trying to uphold the standards for people's housing at the same time that they are trying to keep people housed. So it is a difficult dilemma, but I think that as neighborhoods gentrify and you know, investors start buying up buildings in these neighborhoods, this pressure just gets greater.
As we talk about the new WNYC New York Daily News investigative series on Section 8 housing vouchers, the shortage of them, and how people with Section 8, who the whole purpose of vouchers is that it's supposed to let lower income people not live all concentrated together like in public housing, but find housing in different areas of the city and keep some economic integration a reality in New York, but that's happening less for the various reasons that we're hearing about from WNYC Urban Affairs reporter Cindy Rodriguez, producer on WNYC's Data News team, Jenny Yee, and freelance investigative reporter Lisa Reardon-Seville, who wrote the Daily News version of the series. Jenny, did you want to add something right to that point?
I want to add that when we think about the poverty line, again, that's for a family of three living on less than $21,000 a year. And New York City's poverty rate in 2014 was 20%. So we have a 1.7 million New Yorkers who are living on that amount or less. And that's way more than the Section 8 program has been supporting. It's right now it's supporting almost 300,000 people, but we have 1.7 million people in New York, in our city, that are living below the poverty line.
And some of the other stats that you have: since 2002, the city has lost more than 330,000 apartments that are within reach of low-income tenants. But today there are more than 120,000 names on the waiting list for housing vouchers. So Section 8 users are not only facing competition from gentrifiers who can afford higher rents, Cindy, but also from increasing demand, right?
Yes, that's right. That's right, Brian. And I think that it is really tough out there right now for a low-income tenant to survive in this type of a market with a Section 8 voucher. So you see people really hunkering down in where their apartments are. And if you have a new voucher and you're trying to use it, you know, people in the homeless system get Section 8 vouchers. They really struggle to find apartments, find landlords that will accept their voucher. So it is,
as
it
you've
is
reported
tough for them
on,
right now.
As you've reported on before, that there's a kind of discrimination by source of income that takes place. If people are using vouchers or other kinds of subsidies for their rent, there's a problem with landlords not considering them reliable tenants and therefore not necessarily renting to them. And
right. And the other thing is that, you know, these are these vouchers have caps on them. So a one-bedroom apartment, you can rent an apartment for $1,425. So to some degree, that dictates where someone can live. Now, there's experiments with changing that a bit, and with the federal government basically wants to zoom in on zip codes and set those rents at the levels that are consistent for a very smaller area. So that would mean that you could go to, I'm just going to give this as an example, maybe like Park Slope or a more affluent neighborhood, the amount of the voucher would increase, and then you would go to the very northern tip of the Bronx and the voucher would decrease.
That's a proposal, right, to peg voucher values to specific neighborhoods, yes?
Right, that's right. And in New York City, housing officials do not like that idea because they feel like the voucher would never increase enough for someone to live in an area like Park Slope. And at the same time, it would decrease in an area like the northern Bronx and would really cause a lot of problems for the people that are there.
Huh. Let's take a call from a landlord calling in. Ken in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ken.
Yes. Well, there's two things I wanted to mention. First, if you have I own Section 8 properties in Pennsylvania and Connecticut. I don't own any in New York. There must be something truly different about the New York program, because if you are tired of having your Section 8 tenant, each of those leases is 1 month. You tell them, I mean, it's 12 months long. You tell them that you're not going to renew the lease. When the 12 months is up, they have to leave and they have to find a new place.
Lisa, are you familiar with this?
You don't have to fail inspections and destroy your apartment and put the people in danger.
Oh, I understand, because you can just kick them out. Probably, well, I don't know. I'm guessing it might be the rent stabilization laws here, Lisa, that are
different. In Ridgewood, Queens, the tenants were all rent stabilized. So 12 of them had a voucher, which offered, and a number of them who were in this lawsuit were simply rent stabilized. So it depends on the building. Not, you know, there are many people who have a voucher who aren't in a rent stabilized apartment, but many people, particularly in the Bronx, are because they live in large apartments.
Pete in Hamilton Heights, you're on WNYC. Hi, Pete.
Hi. I just had one question. I'll take it up the air. The waiting list. I had a cousin who actually got on the waiting list for a Section 8 voucher, and that waiting list was about a 10-year wait. What's the number now, a time period now? Thank you.
Jenny, is there a numerical answer to that?
I think I haven't heard of the current waiting list time.
Cindy, do you know?
God, I do not. I know that the waiting list has been closed for a really long time. NYCHA, for the first time this year, actually was giving out new vouchers. But it is, I believe the waiting list is like 121,000 people.
And
yes, people do wait on it for years.
So it's years. If there are that many people who qualify for vouchers, then why aren't there that many vouchers? Why the shortage, Cindy?
Well, I think that that's something that's being discussed a lot more in housing policy circles. This idea that a housing voucher is not an entitlement. What I mean by that is food stamps is an entitlement. You apply for food stamps. If you meet the income limits, you get food stamps. If you apply for housing and you meet the income limits, you don't get the voucher. You get put on waiting lists because there is there's a real short supply of it.
And in fact, I interviewed recently Vicky Bean, the city's housing commissioner, and I asked her in the context of the presidential race what the de Blasio administration most wants from the next president of the United States, what's relevant to housing in New York in the presidential race. And she mentioned a few things, and one of them was more funding for Section 8 vouchers. So they can just, because it's largely a federal program, right? And then they could just release more of these vouchers into circulation.
Yeah, that's true. If you look at the proposed federal budget, you'll see $21 billion for Section 8. $88 million of that is for homeless families, because I think that is the Obama administration's key way to try to solve the crisis of homeless families. And then you see the funding for public housing, which is way smaller. It's a much smaller portion of how it's like like $6.5 billion for public housing, which is interesting, you know, because if you think about it, in New York City, if you're talking about integrating neighborhoods, at least public housing in many ways is doing that in New York City. You know, you have developments that were built in areas that at the time were not desirable, but today they are desirable. So you have many developments in Chelsea. You have many developments on the Lower East Side. You have many developments on the Upper West Side. So, you know, it's an interesting policy choice, and I think we've asked many of the people that we've interviewed along the way, wouldn't it just be easier in some ways to fund public housing? And I think the answer is always, well, that's not the political reality right now, and that's not going to happen. Mm.
Part one of the three-part series aired today. I just want to give people a little bit of a preview of part two, which focuses on the Hasidic community in South Williamsburg, where, as the Daily News version puts it, Section 8 tenants make up more than 30% of residents living smack in the middle of the city's hottest real estate market. It says, we also know that 55% of Hasidic households live below the federal poverty line, nearly triple the rate in the city as a whole. And in this neighborhood, one example you give in the radio piece is from the Broadway Triangle area where South Williamsburg meets Bed-Stuy, where developers actually do, you report, have an incentive to house Section 8 tenants. So here's a clip from a community leader that Cindy interviewed in South Williamsburg.
Because of the lack of housing, because of the importance of a tight-knit community to be around the religious and communal infrastructure, you see the cluster. They have nowhere to go.
So what's the story there, Cindy? Is the Hasidic community in South Williamsburg more successful than other people with the same poverty-level income in getting the vouchers?
Well, I think they're more successful. Yeah, I think they are successful in getting them and in using them because that was Rabbi David Niederman, and, you know, he also talks about how there is no stigma there with Section 8. So landlords more. I'm sorry, am I losing you?
No, I think, you might have lost me there for a minute. I was just acknowledging what you were saying. Lisa, what would you add to that from your reporting?
I would add that just sort of so we know, the city has an anti-discrimination law against source of income, so you're not actually allowed to discriminate against someone with a voucher. Now, the reality is, you know, more complicated, I think. But in the Hasidic community, there's a real communal effort to house people. It's all the way to the top, the leaders have tried to build to meet the demand. And so there's been an increase in supply, and people are willing to take the voucher in that community because it's a way to stay together.
All right. Part two of the series coming up. Is it tomorrow, part two, on the air, Cindy?
Yes, it is, Brian.
And how about the Daily?
And also in the Daily News.
How about the Daily News version? What days is the series being published?
Also, it'll be at the same time, so Tuesday and Wednesday.
For parts two and three. Yeah. We thank WNYC Urban Affairs reporter Cindy Rodriguez, Jenny Yee from our data news team, and freelance investigative reporter Lisa Reardon-Seville, who's writing the print version of the story in the Daily News. Thanks all.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.